Webcasting around the world from the desert metropolis of Phoenix, Arizona, this is The Dividing Line. The Apostle Peter commanded Christians to be ready to give a defense for the hope that is within us, yet to give that answer with gentleness and reverence. Our host is Dr. James White, Director of Alpha and Omega Ministries and an elder at the Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church. This is a live program, and we invite your participation. If you'd like to talk with Dr. White, call now at 602-973-4602 or toll free across the United States. It's 1-877-753-3341. And now with today's topic, here is James White.
And good morning. Welcome to The Dividing Line. I was just rushing around like anything. Would have had it all done in time, except I don't have a flash video player on this laptop. I got the file down, and then I realized, oh, no, I have to convert it. So I am still running about like a chicken with my head cut off here because I wanted to play for you, and I will play for you, a video clip. Hopefully Rich won't pull it out till it's converted. Yes, good. That would really be a bad thing. I want to play some material for you today, and I was just working as fast as my little, not overly fast, connection. Sometimes having the speed I have at home would be useful here. I only get 60, 70, 80, you know, KBPS down, and I get 270 at home. So, I would have been there if we'd had that, but unfortunately, just didn't get it done. So, what I want to attempt to do today is, read for you some material that, I think at least Americans should be interested in. I confess that maybe if you are outside of the United States, you won't be quite as interested in all of this as Americans would be interested in this. But the fact of the matter is religion has very much entered the stage of the political campaign taking place in the United States. And it certainly is the case that the American president is an important person all around the world. One of the scariest things I saw in the 2004 election was when people started talking about how Europeans should have a vote in the American presidential election. I'm sorry, I know some wonderful European people, but on the whole, European society as a whole is dead. It's just twitching a few last times before it becomes Europistan. And the fact that Europeans detest God's law as a whole, detest their own history, detest their own nations, and in essence put up with anything except what is true or just or honest or good or so on and so forth, to have them have anything to do with elections over here is just really, really, really bad thing. But I'm sure there's lots of folks over here that would like that. So I imagine there are people all around the world that are interested in the elections. And what has happened in the United States has been that starting about, what was it, a month and a half ago or so, all of a sudden, you can't get good preaching on Fox News or CNN or anything else like that. Except when John MacArthur shows up on Larry King, you're not going to get much accomplished along those lines. But all of a sudden, we started seeing a lot of really bad preaching, and that from the United Church of Christ, which, of course, is the same denomination that Barry Lynn is an ordained minister in. That should give you some idea of the perspective of this denomination, which is far, 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 far removed from being anywhere near biblical in any way, shape, or form in its viewpoints and its theology and so on and so forth. And we started seeing the Reverend Jeremiah Wright over and over and over and over and over again on the television. And I personally, you know, at first, it was just like, I didn't honestly expect this to be a really big thing. But then I started listening, and I started talking to some other folks. And while I was back on Long Island, I had the opportunity of speaking with a pastor there. And he mentioned that Reverend Wright had been on Hannity and Combs about a year earlier and had made direct reference to certain sources of his theology. And this is where I come in, because now we're talking theology. Now we're talking claims to things that are biblical. And so I happen, what I have here is the clip from a portion of the clip from Hannity and Combs. And I want you to listen to what Jeremiah Wright is saying and listen to whom he refers Hannity. If Hannity really wants to understand black theology, if he wants to understand where Jeremiah Wright is coming from, listen to whom he makes reference.
Reverend Wright has been encouraged to avoid interviews. He did make a brief appearance on Fox's Hannity and Combs.
He doesn't know anything more about theology than I know about brain surgery. So, here's my point to you. You're not going to talk about theology in context. If you're not going to talk about liberation theology that came out of the 60s, systematized black liberation theology that started with Jim Cone in 1968.
Reverend?
And the writings of Cone and the writings of Dwight Hopkins and the writings of womanist theologians and Asian theologians and Hispanic theologians.
Reverend, I got to get this.
Then you can't talk about the black values. Liberation theology, sir? Reverend, do you know liberation theology?
I studied theology. I went to a seminar,
do you know black liberation theology?
I'm very aware of what you're calling black liberation, but let me get my question out.
Do you know black theology?
Reverend, I'm going to give you a chance to answer your question.
How many Combs books have you read?
Reverend?
How many Combs books have you read?
Reverend?
Okay, there you go. How many of Combs' books have you read? That was Jeremiah Wright. That was over a year ago, as I understand it. And that was before all the clips hit and all the rest of that stuff. And so I ordered Cone's books. And didn't really do anything for a while. I actually plopped them on Rich's desk, and he didn't do anything with them either. In fact, most of the books I plop on Rich's desk, that's just sort of, they look good, you know, so they're sitting there, they look, you know, but, you know. So, I was watching this same video I was just quoting from, and they started talking about the stuff that is actually said in these books, and I couldn't believe it, so I started looking through this particular book, and this one is called Black Theology and Black Power by James H. Cone. James H. Cone is Charles A. Briggs Distinguished Professor of Systematic Theology at Union Theological Seminary in New York, a very well-known seminary, so far off the left that it should be on Mars, theologically, but that's where it is. And so this is under Black Studies in Theology, Orbis Books from New York. And so this morning I started looking through it yesterday, and so this morning I started marking some things down. And I just sort of started at a particular place and just started reading. And I was just absolutely amazed at what I saw. I started around page 130 or so, and I started marking things, and I'm just going to read them for you. And we'll see what you think of the theology of black theology. Since it seeks to interpret black power religiously, black theology endeavors to reorder the Christian tradition in view of the black predicament and to destroy the influence of heretical white American Christianity. I'm at a little bit of a loss. I will be at a little bit of a loss throughout this reading. To understand, see, I don't think as a racist. I can't think as a racist. And what I've read here is one of the most racist books I've ever seen. All you got to do is take out the word black, put in the word white, and you'll see exactly what I mean. If someone were talking about the view of the white predicament and to destroy the influence of radical black American Christianity, everybody, you know, whoever this is, would be fired, never work again anywhere in the Western world, but just change the words around and everything is okay. See, that's part of the great hypocrisy of Western culture today. But see, I can't think this way. And the reason I can't think this way is personal. Do you remember your first friend? Do you think back? Who was your first friend outside of your family, not brothers and sisters? Who was your first friend? A person outside your family unit, didn't sleep in your house, went and slept in some other house. So this is someone outside your family unit. Who was your first friend? My first friend was named Kevin. And Kevin was a Negro. That's what we called him. That's what he called himself. And he was medium brown, I would say, with an afro. So his hair looked a lot different than mine did. But he was my friend. And he was my first friend. And I remember meeting Kevin's parents. And Kevin's dad, now remember, I'm about 3 years old. 3 to 4 years old, both. Well, all the way through five, that's when we moved, and that's when I didn't see Kevin anymore. But when I met his dad, he scared me to death because he was huge. He was a big black cop. So he had a gun, and he had a badge and uniform, and he was as black as midnight. I mean, you see some of the black Africans that have come over, and where you don't, there is not a gradation here. It pure black, no nothing. And that's what he was. He was just as black as can be. And then I met Kevin's mom, and she was almost albino white. I mean, this was the palest, whitest woman I'd ever seen. So my first friend was a different color than me. And he had hair that I couldn't begin to understand. I really didn't give him much thought because we were playing with my cars. And he played with cars the way I played with cars. And we played G.I. Joe, and that was just all there was to it. And I didn't give any thought to it. And his dad was pitch black, and his mom was lily white, and that was okay with me, too. I was too young to realize that in the mid-1960s, that was pretty unusual. So you see, I can't think this way. I'm sorry. But the idea of white and black and seeing them as separate and just the deep racism of Cone and these people, I don't understand it. I can't think this way because I guess I just got kicked out of the proper way of thinking back when I was a kid, when I was very, very young. And so, you know, when I think white American Christianity, what on earth is that? There is no such thing. Sorry, you may want to talk about it. What is it? And you're going to see that it's only going to get worse and worse, and I'm going to get more and more frustrated as I read this stuff. I continue on, page 131. Black theology advocates a religious system of values based on the experiences of the oppressed because it believes white values must either be revolutionized or eliminated. There is a strong sense of violence in this book. There is a strong sense of threat. There is a strong sense of violence in this book, and though it's supposed to be a Christian book of theology. No, it's heresy. That's what I'm talking about. It's pure, simple heresy. It needs to be identified for what it is. Don't call this stuff Christianity because it's not. Christianity is not a racist religion. And if you try to appropriate it to promote your racism, I'll be just as angry with the white nutcase KKK as with the black nutcase KKK. It doesn't matter to me. It's all heresy. Don't call it biblical. There's neither male nor female, bond or free, Jew or Gentile. You're all one in Christ Jesus. And you want to try to make a Christianity out of your race? That's called heresy. Okay? That's against the gospel. I'm going to stand against it. Whatever else you want to call it, that's all there is to it. So it goes on here. This term oppressed. These folks refer to themselves as slaves. My goodness. This Wright has a house that I couldn't even pay the insurance on. And he's a slave? What? I don't get this. I'm sorry. My folks came here. I traced my genealogy back. And on my father's side, my folks came here after the War of Northern Aggression. The Civil War. Whatever you want to call the thing. They came here after that. They were poor. They were dirt farmers, for crying out loud, from Scotland. Don't hold me accountable for for stuff I had nothing to do with. I've never owned a slave, and I don't know anybody who's ever been one. And people who want to perpetuate this, I just go, why? I mean, it would be like me trying to build my entire identity around the English persecution of Scottish people 500 years ago. You know? Making up a whole new Christianity based on that. It is absurd. But that's what's being presented. Unbelievable. Such a value system means, of course, an end to the influence of white seminaries and their middle-class white ideas about God, Christ, and the church. This is not This does not necessarily mean burning of their buildings with Molotov cocktails. What is meant is the removal of the oppressive ideas from the black community which the seminaries perpetuate. We must replace them with black consciousness. That is, with Nathaniel Paul, Daniel Payne, Nat Turner, Marcus Garvey, Elijah Muhammad, and Malcolm X. Instead of having courses dealing with the theology of Reinhold Niebuhr, or Rudolf Bultmann, or Emil Brunner, man, did I get all that stuff at Fuller, we need to deal with the theology of Henry Garnett and other black revolutionaries. Yeehaw. Well, even there, you know, I wouldn't mind getting rid of most of those guys myself, liberal ones. I continue on. Page 134. Black theology believes that we are on the threshold of a new order, the order of a new black community. The black power movement is a transition in the black community from non-being to being. In the old order, black people were not allowed to be human. We were what white America permitted us to be, nothings. We took on false identities which destroyed our real selves, our beautiful black selves. The new order, partially realized now but not fully consummated, is an order which affirms black self-identity. Again, just take the word black out and put anything else in you want. White, brown, green, Asian, Chinese, Mexican, I don't care. Stick it in there and you'll hear what's being said. This is racism, pure and simple, going under the name of Christianity. Page 135. It is a theology, black theology, which confronts white society as the racist antichrist, communicating to the oppressor that nothing will be spared in the fight for freedom. Same page. Black theology believes the problem of racism will not be solved through talk, but through action. The next subtitle is revolution. Page 137, black power seeks to change the structure of the black community, its thought forms, values, culture. It tells black people to love themselves, and by so doing, confront white racism with a mode of behavior inimical to everything white. That's racism. The revolutionary attitude of black theology stems not only from the need of black people to defend themselves in the presence of white oppression, but also from its identity with biblical theology. Check this out. Like biblical theology, listen to this. It affirms the absolute sovereignty of God over his creation. This means that ultimate allegiance belongs only to God. Therefore, black people must be taught not to be disturbed about revolution or civil disobedience if the law violates God's purpose for man. The Christian man is obligated by a freedom grounded in the Creator to break all laws which contradict human dignity. Through disobedience to the state, he affirms his allegiance to God as creator and his willingness to behave as if he believes it. Civil disobedience is a duty in a racist society. That's page 137, just in case you wanted to hear the sovereignty of God grossly misused. Page 139. These questions are not easy to answer. The real danger of these questions, the question is violence. These questions are not easy to answer. The real danger of these questions is the implied literalism in them. Let me back up and give you more context. He talks about Jesus' statements about nonviolence. And he's now responding to Jesus' statements about nonviolence. The real danger of these questions is the implied literalism in them. Like the fundamentalist who stressed the verbal inspiration of Scripture, and we certainly know what the United Church of Christ thinks about that. This view suggests that ethical questions dealing with violence can be solved by asking, what would Jesus do? We cannot solve ethical questions of the 20th century by looking at what Jesus did in the first. Our choices are not the same as his. Being Christian does not mean following in his steps. His steps are not ours. And thus we are placed in an existential situation in which we are forced to decide without knowing what Jesus would do. The Christian does not ask what Jesus would do as if Jesus were confined to the first century. He asks, what is he doing? Where is he at work? And even though these are the right questions, they cannot be answered once and for all. Page 141. While America is the richest country in the world as a result of the involuntary servitude of blacks and the annihilation of Indians, this country persists in expecting black people to accept their ideals of freedom and democracy. That's one of the things that just drives me nuts about racism. Not only do racists insist upon making themselves the constant victims of everything, but they, in doing so, take away the fact that my forebears lived as dirt poor people to build up their own wealth. And they didn't do it on the back of blacks or Indians. And it is insulting to me for people to insist that they did. It's a lie, first of all. It requires changing history. It's dishonest. But it's also exceptionally insulting. It is offensive to me. And since you never want to offend anybody, well, unless you're a white Christian, I guess, I'm still going to lodge my offense. Page 142. It does not matter. Listen to this. It does not matter how many gains are made in civil rights. Progress is irrelevant. The face of the black revolutionary will always be there as long as white people persist in defining the boundary of black being. It is the price one pays for oppression. Those sound like pretty threatening words to you. They do to me. If a white person said it, changed the words around, they'd probably be brought up on hate crimes charges. Yep. But we live in the West, and the West is filled with hypocrisy. Page 143. Whether the American system is beyond redemption, we will have to wait and see. But we can be certain that black patience has run out. And unless white America responds positively to the theory and activity of black power, and by the way, black power is always capitalized in this book, just like names of deity. And unless white America responds positively to the theory and activity of black power, then a bloody, protracted civil war is inevitable. Inevitable. Now remember, did we not listen to Jeremiah Wright? How many books by Cone have you read? How many books by Cone have you read? You can't understand us unless you read the books by Cone. I'm reading the books by Cone. This is what's preached in Trinity United Church of Christ in Chicago. That's what he preaches. That's what he has said. He has not been shy about this. Let me read it again. Whether the American system is beyond redemption, we will have to wait and see, but we can be certain that black patience has run out, and unless white America responds positively to the theory and activity of black power capitalized, then a bloody, protracted civil war is inevitable. There have occasionally been revolutions, massive redistributions of power without warfare. It is passionately to be hoped that this can be one of them. The decision lies with white America, and not least with white Americans who speak the name of Christ. Page 143, Black Theology and Black Power by Dr. James H. Cone, the man demanded by Reverend Jeremiah Wright to be read to understand his theology and his teaching.
I have a question here, because when I hear the word theology and somebody's saying this is my theology, I keep looking for their definition or their view of God in there. And I don't hear that being addressed, except perhaps in one area. You mentioned that the term black power is capitalized, and I wonder, are they looking at black power as the definition of
the only relevant, you'd have to read the whole book, but the only relevant materials that I've encountered has been the assertion that, if God is for the blacks, that they are the elect. And since God is for people who are oppressed and suffering, they're oppressed and suffering, then God is for them. I've got more to read. I'm not done. I know it's getting close to break, but I got more to read. I'm not done. Bring this down so I can find that clip again. I want to make sure to have that ready to play. But I've got more stuff here to give you, because it's pretty amazing to me what is really to be found in this work. Let me read you some more. That was on page 143. Now, under the topic reconciliation, page 144, white people have short memories. White people have short memories. Again, if a conservative were to reverse the words and say the same words, they would be out of any political race they're in. What do you mean white people have short memories? Well, you don't remember slavery. Yeah, I wasn't there, and neither were you. You've never been owned as a slave. I've never owned one. And it is pure hypocrisy. It is absurdity. People of morality must stand up and identify this as the immoral thing that it is. It's wrong to continue to perpetuate this. It's evil. Call it what it is, people. First, let me say, page 144, first, let me say that reconciliation on white racist terms is impossible, since it would crush the dignity of black people. Under these conditions, blacks must treasure... Listen to this. This is supposed to be Christianity. Under these conditions, blacks must treasure their hostility, bring it fully into consciousness as an irreducible quality of their identity. If white people insist on laying the ground rules for reconciliation, which can only mean black people denying the beauty of their blackness, then black people must do everything within their power to destroy the white thing. That's what it says. The white thing. I don't know what the white thing is either, but that's what it says. Black people can only speak of reconciliation when the black community is permitted to do its thing. The black community has experienced the crushing white thing too long. Therefore, black theology believes that in order for reconciliation to be meaningful and productive, black people must have room to do their thing. The black community itself must lay down the rules of the game. White oppressors are incompetent to dictate the terms of reconciliation because they are enslaved by their own racism, and will inevitably seek to base the terms on their right to play God in human relationships. The history of slavery and Jim Crow and integration efforts renders white people virtually incapable of knowing even how to talk to black people as persons. I'm on page 145 now. It is this fact that nullifies the good intentions of concerned white religious people, who insist that they are prepared to relate to black people as human beings. This man does not believe that white people can interact with black people as human beings. I'm telling you, I have never encountered a white racist any more racist than this man is as a black racist. It is incredible to me. It is offensive to me that this kind of stuff is pandered to in theological seminaries as if it has something to do with Christianity. Just disgusting to me. Absolutely disgusting. I continue on. They simply do not know how, since racism is inseparable from the history of America, And since practically all white people in this country are taught from birth to treat blacks as things, black theology must counsel black people to be suspicious of all whites who want to be friends of black people. Therefore, the real question is not whether black theology sees reconciliation as an end, but rather on whose terms we are to be reconciled. My goodness! I hope you feel the very same revulsion at this that I feel when I hear ignorant white racists. I mean, at least many of the white racists are just dumb. I mean, let's be honest about it. We've seen some of these folks. They ain't smart. This man's not stupid. And his racism goes far beyond pure bias and bigotry to his entire worldview. At least you can say some white racists don't even know what a worldview is. This is scary. This is frightening stuff. I continue on page 145. The problem of reconciliation is the oppressor's problem. Being accustomed to defining human relations between themselves and the slaves on I-it terms, they naturally think that they have a monopoly on truth and right behavior. But when the slaves begin to say no to the God behavior of the masters are surprised. My goodness, people, there haven't been slaves and masters since anybody listening to me has been alive. Why do you insist upon making it so? You're the one who's perpetuating this. You're the one that's creating this. My goodness. How can any man call himself a Christian and speak like this? I don't comprehend it. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Page 147. We get to a Bible verse. I was looking for Bible verses. I want to be able to talk about the Bible here. Do not misunderstand me. Black theology is a theology which takes seriously God's reconciling act in Jesus Christ. In fact, the heart of the New Testament message is the gospel of reconciliation. As St. Paul says, God was in Christ reconciling the world to himself. 2 Corinthians 5:19. But here's where I should have queued up the Twilight Zone music. Among other things, this means that the wall of hostility is broken down between blacks and whites, making color irrelevant to man's essential nature. But, you knew there had to be a but after all the other stuff we've read, because up to that point he's exactly right. There is no room for racism. There is no room for you talking about the beauty of blackness. But in a white racist society, black theology believes that the biblical doctrine of reconciliation can be made a reality only when white people are prepared to address black men as black men and not as some grease-painted form of white humanity. Black theology will not respond positively to whites who insist on making blacks as white as possible by de-emphasizing their blackness and stressing the irrelevance of color while really living as racists. As long as whites live like white people, through marriage, schools, neighborhood, power, etc., black people must use blackness as the sole criterion for dialogue. What do you say to this kind of stuff? How do you reason with people who have created an entire worldview based upon blackness and whiteness? I don't know what they do with Asians and Mexicans and everybody else, because it just... reality defies this kind of simplicity. That's the whole horrible nature of racism. It is so stupidly simplistic. It's always been what's stupid about racism. And I don't care what color you are. If you're a racist, you're looking at the world in really, really simplistic terms. Aye. Page 149. By the way, the last quote went on to 148. If you're keeping track and would like to read for yourself, which I invite you to do. I wouldn't make any of this stuff up. I couldn't. Couldn't believe it existed. When we analyze the black-white relationship in the 20th century, in the light of God's reconciling work in Jesus Christ, the message is clear. What do you think the message is, folks? For black people, it means that God has reconciled us to an acceptance of our blackness. That's what it says. What's the message of reconciliation in Jesus Christ? Is it redemption from sin, justification, the people of God coming together as one? No, 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 no. For black people, it means that God has reconciled us to an acceptance of our blackness. If the death, resurrection of Christ means anything, it means that the blackness of black people is a creation of God himself. Let me repeat that, because I honestly don't think that any rational person on the planet can begin to understand that one. If the death, resurrection of Christ means anything, it means that the blackness of black people is a creation of God himself. God came into the world in order that black people need not be ashamed of who they are. In Christ, we not only know who we are, but who God is, and this is the heart of the biblical message. Okay, we continue down on page 149. The task of black theology is to inform black people that because of God's act in Christ, they need not offer anyone an apology for being black. Rather, be glad of it. Shout it. It is the purpose for which we are created. This is the meaning of the gospel of reconciliation to black people. Oh, what perversion comes when you tie racism to Scripture. Black theology and black power. James H. Combs.
This is Hannity and Combs.
He doesn't know anything more about theology than I know about brain surgery. So,
here's my point.
No, let me finish. No, here's my point to you. You're not going to talk about theology in context, if you're not going to talk about liberation theology that came out of the 60s, systematized black liberation theology that started with Jim Cone in 1968.
Reverend?
And the writings of Cone and the writings of Dwight Hopkins and the writings of womanist theologians and Asian theologians and Hispanic theologians.
Reverend, I've got to get
talk,
this
in. Then you can't talk about the black value. Liberation theology, sir?
Reverend,
do you know liberation theology?
I studied theology. I went to a seminar
do you know black liberation
theology? I'm very aware of what you're calling black liberation, but let me get my question out.
Do you know black theology?
Reverend, I'm going to give you a chance to answer your question.
How many of Cone's books have you read?
Well, viewers took one thing away from this interview. Reverend Wright is rude. But beyond his remarkable lack of etiquette, Reverend was saying something that was easily overlooked. Let's look again.
No, do you know black liberation theology?
I'm very aware of what you're calling black liberation, but let me get my question out.
No, I didn't ask you what I'm calling. I said, do you know black theology?
Reverend, I'm going to give you a chance to answer your question.
How many of Cone's books have you read?
Reverend?
How many of Cone's books have you read?
There you go. How many of Cone's books have you read? Well, if you've been listening to this program today, you have now read more of James Cone's books than the vast majority of people in the world have, because you've listened to me reading entire sections of it. Yes, sir.
I'm feeling you've heard more than Sean Hannity's read, that's for sure.
Well, yes, but remember, Sean Hannity studied Latin.
He studied Latin. You know, the thing is, in all the different groups that we have encountered and minister to, take the gospel to, the one thread that seems to be constant is how man-centered, even in this, everything is. We've got to look at God. We've got to call our man-centered idealism theology. And it's pure anthropomorphism. It has nothing to do with theology.
It all has to do with us, yeah. And, you know, as I was reading some of that, I could not help but hear direct echoes of things I have heard Muslims saying about Islam. What black theology does for blacks, many Muslims try to do for Islam as not just a religion, but as a culture. And there were a lot of things I had to fight through at Fuller Theological Seminary when I did my first master's degree there in the 1980s. And there was a lot of stuff there that, you know, was just way, way, way out there in you know. But it was good for me. I needed to, you know, it was helping me to become a better apologist to have to interact with that stuff. But there was one thing in one class that stuck with me and was really, 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 really true. And that is, I don't remember the context. I don't even remember who the professor was. I had some great professors. My church history professor was really good. My Romans professor was really good. And New Testament professor, you know, I had some good professors. They were almost always way off to the left of me. But that was a good thing. I learned in that process anyways. And at least back then, you could disagree. And as long as you did your work and you were not penalized for that, thankfully. Be that as it may, the one thing that really struck with me, it struck me and it stuck with me, put them both together there, was the fact that there was a strong emphasis on the universality of Christianity. That this is a message that dare not be identified with a particular culture. There is a great danger, and Western Christianity succumbed in many ways to that danger, gave into it, capitulated to it. The British tried to turn many nations outside of their borders into Brits so as to make them Christians. That's not a good thing to do. It doesn't work. And when you start identifying the Christian faith with a particular culture, there will have to be perversions introduced into the Christian faith. And I remember reading in Acts and seeing that part of the importance of the Acts 15 Council was that it precluded the idea that there would always be a cultural connection to Christianity. That is, it wasn't going to be Jewish. You didn't have to become a Jew to become a Christian. That was part of what's important. And what that means is this is a message that transcends geographical, cultural, linguistic, and temporal bounds. And that's one of the major differences between Christianity and Islam. And remember, by the way, Jeremiah Wright will not condemn even an Islamic cult such as that of Farrakhan. And that's an Islamic cult. You want racism? Oh, my. Wow. The KKK has never thought of anything as racist as Farrakhan. Never. They're not even smart enough to figure that kind of thing out. You want racism? Look at Louis Farrakhan. Wow. Unbelievable. Anyway, one of the great differences between Christianity and Islam, look at what Islam does to the nations where it becomes predominant. Look at what happens to them. What are the great stresses and strains in Islamic countries today? Is the fact that Islam, in essence, tries to turn your culture into a 7th century Arabic culture in dress, practice, and mindset. But this is the 21st century. That creates about 14 centuries worth of strain. And what is Osama bin Laden's whole argument, even against Saudi Arabia, which we would see as an Islamic country? It's not Islamic enough. It's not fully 7th century. And so when Islamic apologists argue that Christianity, see, Jesus was only sent to the Jews. You need to understand that from the Muslim perspective, Jesus was only sent to the Jews. It's Muhammad that was sent to the whole world. The reality is just the opposite. I mean, you really have to turn things on their head to turn Muhammad's message into a worldwide message. It's Jesus' message that's a worldwide message. And when you become a Christian, you become a Christian Turk, or a Russian Christian, or a Chinese Christian, or a Ghanaian Christian, or a Jamaican Christian, or an American Christian. You don't cease being those things. Now, that law of God brings certain things to bear in your life, and if you live in the Netherlands where anything goes now, where all morality has been thrown out the window, as in many European states, that law of God is going to make you a moral Swede or a moral Norwegian or a moral Dutch person. And you're going to stand out. But you don't have to try to change the culture into a first century Jewish culture. That's the difference. That's the difference. And I saw a lot of parallels to what was being said by Cohn to what I see in Islam. Very much so. Frightening stuff. Very, very frightening stuff. Not in the sense of, ooh, I need to be scared of this, but this stuff needs to be discussed more fully. And unfortunately, a lot of evangelicals who are much more concerned about prophecy conferences and conferences on how to do your finances and conferences on whatever other fluff stuff there is out there. And, you know, some conferences, okay, they're fine. If they were just balanced, if we were really looking at the whole counsel of God and thinking about the whole counsel of God and being willing to, if we are willing to do those things, great, fine, wonderful. But the sad fact of the matter is, that's the stuff that's out there. And that's the stuff that draws the people. We need to be thinking about uncomfortable things. Things that might cause us to sit in our houses and turn off our stinking televisions and actually think about eternal values and how we're going to respond to what's going on in our culture around us. 877-753-3341. Not your standard dividing line today. But I took that book down, I started reading, I started marking, and I went, oh my. My, oh my, oh my. Let's talk with Marcus over in California. Hi, Marcus.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm trying to calm down after reading all that.
I know what you mean. It bothers me a great deal. I wanted to tell you that I went to UC Berkeley, and I had a chance to take a couple of African American studies courses.
At UC Berkeley?
Yeah, and you know what that's like.
UC Berkeley, yes. I can just imagine what that's like.
What I realized is, when you look at, I haven't read Cohn myself, but when you look at stuff written by people like that, notice that they define racism, I think, a little differently than the way you're defining it. And the way it's defined from that mindset is basically that you can only really be a racist if you have power to subjugate others.
I am fully aware of that. I do know that. I listened. It was Michael Medved had a lady on, and she was spouting this type of racist stuff. And when he called her on it, she said, "You don't understand. I cannot be a racist. You have to have power to be a racist." And
you know,
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, and the other thing is, I think that what a lot of people don't really think about is it's not really about color. Basically, people who are poor are basically all in the same boat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and with the gap growing between rich and poor growing more and more in this country, there's more and more people in that boat.
Well, you know, I'm not a rich man, and I was raised in a family that was even less well off than I think I am. I'm not sure how to measure such things, but.
Yeah, with inflation and all.
Well, yeah, exactly. And, you know, I've been doing some looking into my history. I think once people get in their mid-40s, they start thinking about their place in the timeline, and they start thinking about their progenitors and their ancestors and stuff. And I've done some looking around, and I come from poor stock. But
yeah.
But my people, Scottish people, people who spoke with a very deep brogue, didn't use that as an excuse to create a subculture where you demonize everybody else.
And that's wrong. No one should do that.
Going on. But who's?
And you're right. You're right. That is exactly what's going on.
But if you try to say that within the black community, you are immediately ostracized.
I know what you mean. I mean, the thing is, like, I'm a part of a Church of God in Christ denomination,
mm-hmm.
and that is a largely African-American denomination. And, yeah, I can see that.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean that we're not going to not say that you can't do that.
Yeah, but that's gonna put you into a really marginalized state, and that's a shame. It shouldn't be that way. But my goodness, someone on the level of a cone, however, what I just read, I don't see where to start in having the conversation there, because he has in essence already
made up his mind.
Well, not only made up his mind, but he's defined the categories in such a way that. From his perspective, I don't exist.
You know, I agree. You're right, and that I know that's not what Jesus came for.
No, no,
the way he died
no.
for us, and all. I mean, that's just not it.
No, it's amazing.
And the funny thing is, it's interesting to me that you're talking about this today, because I talked to my pastor yesterday, and he was saying that when we next time Bible study, he wanted to cover some like those kind of some topics like you were. Just saying that I'm not comfortable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Well, this is, especially within your context, would be exceptionally not comfortable, but I just don't know how we can avoid talking about it, because if we don't talk about it, that's actually talking about it,
just in
a negative fashion. So
I have a feeling that it partly comes from, you know, I kind of look at it as sort of like the same thing as how some people teach that you can't have miracles in church. You know, like all the miracles, like in the first century, God doesn't do that anymore.
Well, in other words, the concept of cessationism.
Yeah, and I think it sort of like goes along the same lines, because I think when people come that way, they gotta, you know, if you don't see God working that way in your life, you have to wonder why.
Well, I think there's a biblical discussion to be had in regards to the nature of the spiritual gifts and their role in the church, but I don't think there's any question whatsoever about
that God still does miracles.
How does he do miracles? That's the question.
That's the question. People go to extreme saying God doesn't do that anymore at all.
Right. I understand. And some people go so far as to say that there are no spiritual gifts at all, even such as discernment, leadership, anything like that, which I didn't even know people went that far until a few years ago when
sure
I encountered
do.
A few. But I'm not sure I see the connection here, because quite honestly, the issue as I see it, and I could make a strong biblical argument at this point, the issue as I see it is, what is the nature of the Christian church? And what is the unity that we have in Christ? And is there such a thing as whiteness or blackness or brownness or whateverness that somehow can become the very defining factor in one's theology and Christian experience? And that frightens me, that there are people who truly do believe. And you know, I've only heard this on television, but now I could see why it would be. There's a lot of people who've just sort of sat back and said, you know, when I see all the clips of Jeremiah Wright's church, I don't see any white people there. And if I was a white person listening to this kind of preaching all the time, I don't know how I could be there either. That really concerns me in a big fashion. But anyway, hey, Marcus, thanks for surviving berserkly, and thanks for being out there listening.
Okay, thank you. I do agree with why it bothers you. It bothers me. It should bother anybody.
Yeah, it certainly should. Thanks, sir. We'll
all
see
right,
you. God bless.
You. Bye-bye.
All right, bye. 877-753-3341. Thought we had a phone call there, but ended up not having a phone call there. Was going to try to sneak him in right at the end, but I didn't know how long that was going to take. And I had other stuff as well, but once you get going reading that stuff, it is just, it's like getting hit in the gut. It really is. You read that and you go, okay, Jeremiah Wright says that is what you need to read to understand where he's coming from. Okay, I think that only made things a whole lot worse. you know, I honestly look at that and just go, how do you respond to that? And in reality, in our society, are you even allowed to respond to that? I mean, I bet you dollars donuts we get negative emails just simply from the fact that I read it. On one side, there's going to be people saying, well, you're just stirring up trouble. You shouldn't read that stuff. Even though he's going on television saying, you need to read these books. Yeah, read them, but just keep it to yourself. No, what do you mean? But then there's going to be others, you know, who in essence, have bought into the Western mindset that if you're in a minority group, now everybody, if you wanted to, could find a way of putting yourself in a minority group. I mean, you know, we all have something that we could claim and hold on to make us somehow in a minority group, and so we can feel like we're marginalized or we're victimized or blah, 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 blah. And I just don't see anything in Christianity that encourages you to be that way. I just don't see it. But in our society, as long as you're in a minority group, you get to say anything you want to say. And the radical Muslims in the United States have learned this. I will never forget. I wish I had had. I just got a new program that grabs any kind of video stream that's showing on my screen and saves it for me. And I wish I had had this before. But I will never forget a video about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, of some Muslims in the United States burning an American flag, and the microphone picked up the Muslim preaching, and what he said, basically what he was saying was, we get to do this because their system grants us the rights to do this. This is a loophole in their system, and we need to take advantage of this so that we can make our protest. Now, everybody knows that once, if they ever accomplished their goal of establishing Sharia, that, of course, Sharia would not allow the reverse. But we need to take advantage of this while we can. And I wish I still had that video. Knowing, having now said it, someone will send me a link. Let's hope so. That'd be nice. But that's what's going on out there. So while we still have the freedom to talk about these things and to read these things, read entire sections of these books, we'll do so. But the sad fact of the matter is, there's a lot of folks who would like to see even that freedom taken away from us. So pray that while we have it, we use the freedoms God gives to us to His honor and to His glory. And we need to think about these things even when they are, in fact, uncomfortable to think about. So we will be back, Lord willing, on this Thursday afternoon. I am at the FIRE conference all next week, and so there will not be any dividing lines next week, unless for some reason I were to call in from California, but I don't know. We'll think about it. We'll see what happens. I mean, hey, we should set up Skype. It almost sounded like I was here, you know, as long as I had a good connection. Well, I'll think about that. Maybe we can test it. Anyways, we'll be back on Thursday. See you then. God bless.
Dividing Line has been brought to you by Alpha and Omega Ministries. If you'd like to contact us, call us at 602-973-4602 or write us at P.O. Box 37106, Phoenix, Arizona 85069. You can also find us on the World Wide Web at aomin.org. That's aomin.org, where you'll find a complete listing of James White's books, tapes, debates, and tracks. Join us again this Thursday afternoon at 4 p.m. for The Dividing Line.